This is Street Knowledge with Chris Graham.
Welcome to the podcast. I am Chris Graham. I've got more of my voice back, and we're going to talk some sports today. Got Scott German with me, and Scott, it's a tough week. We're in that UVA exam break week. Haven't played since last Tuesday. Won't play again till this Saturday. And I don't know. It feels like summertime here with no UVA sports to think about or talk about. It's a tough few days to get through, I think.
Well, it is. So we're beyond commiserating about the loss at West Virginia, and it's still a little tad early to start thinking about the upcoming game against Davidson. So I think when all else fails, you can talk baseball.
Yeah, there's plenty of baseball to get into, and let's go ahead and do that now. And I'm going to lean on my American League East expert, Scott German, here. The news of the last few days, of course, in baseball has been the move of Giancarlo Stanton from the Miami Marlins to the New York Yankees. Now, you know, not a total giveaway. They get Starlin Castro in return and some minor leaguers and some considerations in the future. But essentially, yeah, last year's top home run hitter, Giancarlo Stanton, hit 59 home runs in a pretty big ballpark. I mean, playing half your games in that stadium and hitting 59 home runs says a lot. But the Yankees also, of course, have, you know, they have Aaron Judge. So they'll have the top two home run hitters from last year in the middle of that lineup. And, you know, I don't want to take the wind out of your sails, Scott, but I don't think you're too happy about this from the Baltimore perspective, at least.
Well, no, as an avid Orioles fan, you certainly don't want to see someone the caliber of Stanton going to your chief, your main competitor, your main rival, the Yankees or the Red Sox or the Blue Jays or anyone in the AL East. Not likely he's going to ever land in Toronto, but what bothers me more than anything is that this just doesn't smell real good, and the listeners are following baseball as avidly as I do, or as you do, you know, it was a trade. It was another fire sale that the Miami Marlins organization had become very notorious for. But it's a fire sale that this time around was pretty much started by Derek Jeter. And the fans in Miami were just elated when Jeter, and along with a couple others, became the principal owner of the team, because they thought once and for all, the ownership that had been in place, Jeffrey Lurie and some other minority owners, Jeter and his group would actually want to pump money into the team and keep the payroll up and run it as a real franchise. But so what does Jeter do when he's one of his very first thing is he unloads the home run champion of Major League Baseball, and he coincidentally does it to his former team, where he's going to go into the Yankee Hall of Fame in just a couple of years. He unloads them to the Yankees when I know there were other suitors there. But you know, I'm not going to say that I believe in the conspiracy theory, but I think Major League Baseball really ought to take a good hard look at this and see exactly what's going on deep down in the roots of this.
Now, I'll say, not to defend the evil empire, they have their own defenders, and there's lots of them in New York. Stanton did have a no-trade clause in his contract, and he was out there meeting with teams. He famously met in the last, I guess, about a week, the week out from when the trade was finalized. He met with the Giants and Cardinals. There were two teams he expressed great interest in playing for. Decided when you have a no-trade clause in your contract, you can veto whoever you want to veto, and he decided after meeting with those two organizations not to go in either of those directions. You know, obviously, he's signed to a contract, so he's going to make the money he's going to make. But for reasons unknown, at least not publicly known, he decided not to go in either of those two directions. And really, when you start looking at the amount of money he signed to, now the Marlins signed him a couple years back to, what was it, 12? I think it was a 12-year contract, which is just absurd, one. They were trying to lock him up at that time to keep him off the market, really, for the end of his career. But, of course, when the Marlins' fortunes went south, which they were bound to, they're the Marlins, after all, that also made it hard for them to keep him. But really, when you look at the amount of that contract, the length of that contract, unless he were willing to agree to a buyout or taking years away in exchange for some sort of signing bonus, it really only left a few teams in baseball that could pay that money out over that period of time. Probably just leaving the Dodgers and the Yankees. After the Giants and Cardinals were ruled by Stanton to be out of this, you're talking again about the Dodgers and the Yankees. The Dodgers already have four, maybe five good outfielders. They don't need another guy out there to clog things up, in that franchise. And so that left pretty much the Yankees if the Marlins were going to do anything. And I think a bigger question here is, the future of the Marlins in Miami. You mentioned, Scott, they've gone through numerous fire sales. I mean, this is a franchise that's won two World Series dating back 1997, 2003. But each of those teams they had to break down afterwards because they couldn't afford them because fans don't go to games there. They don't have a good TV contract in Miami. And so, at some point, why continue with this franchise playing in a city that just doesn't embrace baseball? Because all they do is they develop stars like, in this case, Giancarlo Stanton, and then have to give them away and rebuild for the future. To me, that's the bigger question here is just the viability long-term of this franchise.
Well, and it's not only with Miami, but up south of Florida over on the Gulf Coast, the same situation exists with Tampa. They draw nothing. And the consensus is that these owners are just really not that interested in putting a winning team on the field. They're just interested in bringing in whatever revenue that the league gets from television and advertising. It's not nearly what the NFL gets because MLB derives their revenue primarily from local network, local broadcast, local television. So, the fans of Miami is not a great baseball town and not that great of a sports town from what most people say. And so, you're right. That's the big problem is, are they just going to continue to take in the MLB money and basically serve as a farm team for the big empires like the Yankees, the Dodgers, the Cubs? Because that's not good for baseball. It's just absolutely not good for baseball. Now, from what I also understand is the Jeter deal with the Yankees or with the Marlins is that there is a possibility that once the team gets to a point where they can be fiscally sound and paying sending that kind of money with the revenue the Marlins generate was certainly the opposite, being fiscally sound, that this club could be moved. And one of the destinations, the landing spots that I've heard rumors of is that New York, the metropolitan New York area, could get a third Major League Baseball team back in Brooklyn, which is coming out of complete left field. But, the city could certainly, the region could support it if it's run correctly. It's 4-2 now very well. So, we don't know. I guess we don't know. But, again, being an Orioles fan, being an AL East, it's kind of disheartening to see these franchises just buy up this available talent.
Well, and I pointed out earlier, they had to give away an asset, and Castro is an asset. He's a good second baseman. I mean, in his heart, second base is a difficult position to restock. A guy who hits close to 300 and can field like Castro can, you don't just shake the tree and find guys like that. So they did. At least the Marlins got something in return, and the Yankees will have to worry about whether or not they're too top heavy. You got two guys in Stanton and Judge who strike out a lot. Also, I would question, at least this is something we'll see play out over the first few months of next season. Stanton has played baseball in a market where there's not a lot of attention. He's not played in a playoff race. So as a result, he had 59 home runs last year. He's had a good career down in Miami, but he's never played in the pressure of an environment like New York where, if you have a bad batting practice, there are 50 microphones in your face asking you why. So you'll have to wonder, how he'll adjust to that, how he'll fit into the lineup there. You know, I don't think you just plug in 59 home runs and say he's going to do that again in New York. I think, you know, there's certainly, you know, there it's a different feel. I mean, some guys rise to the occasion in New York and some guys flame out in New York. So, you know, we'll have to see how he responds. I mean, he's a guy that's, you know, he was going to make a lot of money no matter where he played. He wanted the playoff race. You know, the Marlins are rebuilding. He made it clear to the Marlins ownership he didn't want to be a part of another rebuild there. He's been a part of a couple of those. But now he's got his wish, and we'll see how he rises to the occasion, or if he does rise to the occasion, as the case may be, with a good team, a team that obviously went to Game 7 of the ALCS this year. But I don't know that you just pencil in 59 home runs and say this guy's going to do the same thing or even better in New York. That's a different place.
You're exactly right. He's going to have more mics in his general vicinity during batting practice than he probably would have at any game situation. The media pressure in New York is going to be enormous. But you know, the other circumstance surrounding that trade is that the Marlins they're probably actively shopping Castro. I believe what's the second baseman that they attained for the Yankees was Sterling Castro. Was that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Consensus is that he may never even play for the Marlins. He may be moved this week. Then to continue to cut salaries on that organization. So you know, it just doesn't ring out very well. But you know, as long as MLB does not have a salary cap, and that's never going to happen in Major League Baseball. The luxury tax is the closest thing that the clubs are going to face. This is the kind of, you know, this is the landscape, and this is what baseball fans are going to have to you know, be used to get used to.
Well, and you know, it's not just an issue with those two Florida teams, as you mentioned, Scott, Tampa, of course, and Miami. You have Oakland, who, you know, continually builds up and builds back down and starts over. You've got, you know, Kansas City did it well. Kansas City for 30 years, went without a playoff appearance as a quote-unquote small market team. Won a World Series a couple years ago, but you know, you see a lot of teams that, you know, fashion themselves being small market. Actually, Philadelphia is not a small market, but the Phillies have been playing like a small market team the last few years. You know, it's really just a matter of the commitment of the ownership group and management to put that winning team on the field. And it's easier said than done, I guess. And it's frustrating for fans. I mean, if you're an Oakland A's fan, for example, how many iterations of the Oakland A's have you seen dating back to Billy Beane's first tenure as general manager there? At the beginning, it was 10-year general manager there. You've had some great teams and never gotten over the hump. Tampa Bay's actually been very competitive despite having that, you know, historically low payroll over the last decade or so. Again, Florida's the Miami team has won two World Series in the last 20 years with that approach of, okay, we'll build and then we'll build back down. You know, really, it's only the only teams that don't have to worry about the money year in and year out are teams like the Dodgers and Yankees. And actually, let's think about it. When's the last time either of those won a World Series? I think the Yankees won in 2009. Would have been among those two. You know, that's the most recent series, and that's almost a decade ago now. So it's frustrating for fans. Like, you know, you follow the O's closely. I follow the Nats closely. We'd love to see our local teams who are very competitive. You know, several playoff appearances in the last 6-7 years from those two franchises. But, you know, are they competing on the even scale with the likes of the Yankees and Dodgers? Maybe not. But then again, you know, like I said, the last World Series for either of those two teams, a winning World Series, was almost a decade ago. So maybe baseball's interesting. Baseball's interesting, you know, because it doesn't matter what the amount of money is a guy's making. It's a matter of whether or not in October you can get 9 innings out of guys. You can get so many runs out of guys. Baseball evens out over the course of a season, and doesn't always reward the richest teams. That's one thing we all love about baseball. A lot of folks listening to this podcast remember UVA baseball from a couple years ago winning a College World Series when they had no reason to. Baseball is the most democratic of all sports. And so the Yankees, good form. They got Giancarlo Stanton, but that's no guarantee that they'll be successful next year. I have faith in baseball. That's the case.
It's not a guarantee, but it certainly, you know, it absolutely improves their odds. And if they're always a team that's in the mix, then ultimately, I mean, eventually they're going to win it. They're going to win it. You know, the frustrating thing, you talked about Kansas City and Oakland. If you look at baseball, and again, as you follow it as much as we do, and I like to follow the inside, the numbers type thing, what's really frustrating is if you're a fan of KC, Oakland, Milwaukee, those are, there's some other, San Diego, those are small market teams, and they know it, and they know their limitations, and they don't really have what you would call just hated rivals. So the fans of those teams kind of know what the bar is going into a season. And if you can have a season like KC did a couple years ago and actually win the World Series, then my goodness, that's just an unbelievable feat. But the other teams, there's a bunch of teams, and our two teams are in that category. The Yankees, the Orioles and the Nationals. They're not big market teams, but they're not small market teams either. In fact, they're mid-market teams, mid-majors, I guess, if you will. They're mid-market teams that have hated rivals. The Orioles, their rival is the Yankees, the Red Sox, and they're playing those two teams the way the current schedule. They're playing the Yankees and the Red Sox between 18 times each, 36 games a year between those two teams. You throw in Toronto, another major market team, and it almost just makes you feel like you're going to a gunfight with a water gun because, you know, eventually you're competing against teams with almost unlimited payrolls, and it just is a lot of times it's kind of disheartening. Nationals are pretty much in the same boat. Right now the Nationals have had it pretty easy the last couple of years because the Mets have been terrible, the Braves have been terrible, the Phillies, but those are all Phillies and Mets are certainly major market teams. Atlanta's probably on the border of being a major market team. So it's going to get tougher for the Nationals as well in the next few years.
Oh, yeah. You're right. The National League East is, you know, at least potentially could be as powerful as an American League East if those franchises were to rebuild. I mean, Philadelphia had a run a few years ago with that group led by the late Roy Halladay and the group around him. They had a nice run, won a World Series, were in the playoffs a few years. Of course, the Braves, you know, dating back now to the 1990s and 2000s, had a long run as NL East champions. The Mets, all right, they're in New York. That's, you know, potential major market. They've just had so many injuries the last few years, but you know, the Phillies, I think, will be better this year. The Braves maybe are a year away. Of course, the Marlins are the Marlins. But, it's not going to be any easier for the Nats. I think the Nats year is this. The Nats have a deadline of this year. You don't know what's going to happen with Bryce Harper after 2018. There's a feeling that, you know, push it this year as much as possible. Probably a similar feeling for the O's, actually, because the O's have some guys whose contracts come up this year. And so there's probably an extra pressure in Baltimore to maximize what you can this year because of the uncertainty afterwards in terms of contracts. So, yeah, both of our teams that we follow have a similar, you know, win now kind of pressure, you know, whether or not that stands to be the case. Bryce Harper with the Nationals and Manny Machado with the O's both coming up, their contracts coming up this year, they both may very well sign with their incumbent teams and stay around and be a part of the future. And, of course, the Nats have Strasburg and Scherzer signed for longer terms. But that said, yeah, it still feels like this year is a sort of make-it-or-break-it year for both the local teams.
Yeah, and there's no guarantee. I mean, the Orioles not only have Machado, but they also are looking at this walk year after this coming season for Adam Jones, along with some other good players, not marquee name players, but role players. And, you know, over 162 games, you need those players on your roster that can come in and get you a three-hit game and relieve somebody, or come in and pitch a couple of innings and, you know, hold the game where it is. They have a number of those players that aren't getting the publicity that after 2018, it's going to be interesting to see if they're still wearing the Orioles uniforms. But, you know, it's still, you want it to be. And when you're playing the Yankees, the Red Sox, the Astros, it'll be the Braves and the Mets. They're going to get better. You want to feel like you're on even ground. And that's not what Major League Baseball is all about.
So, yeah, that's the other news in baseball. Let's change gears a little bit in baseball. UVA announced its first Baseball Hall of Fame class last week, Scott. I'm sure you saw the news there. A lot of names covering different eras of UVA baseball history. You know, whenever you have a first Hall of Fame class, you've got to do that. They had 15 names come out. Any surprises there? And, of course, there are a lot of good names in there, too. But your thoughts on – well, you know, having seen that Hall of Fame class announced, your thoughts on the guys who are going to be honored next month in the first Hall of Fame?
Not really. I thought the modern era players, if you will, modern era meaning the players that have come along right about the time of the renaissance of UVA baseball with Chris O'Connor, those were all pretty well expected. I think that the only one that I was a little taken back with, but I'm very pleased that he was on that list, and I think you're going to probably know where I'm going, and he's not a player, but for those of us that followed UVA baseball when there was maybe 30 people at a game, I was very happy to see Dennis Wilmot make that initial Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I agree. I was with you there, yes.
You know, Dennis toiled in relative obscurity, and did a lot of stuff for very little pay, not making anywhere near the money Coach O'Connor's making. And, you know, they weren't great UVA teams, but, you know, they weren't teams to be laughed at either. They had decent – they usually put a respectable team on the field. You know, at least from my standpoint, that's what I remember about the Dennis Wilmot era.
Well, and what I would say, too, is I don't think people pay attention to this very much, but we all know that, you know, UVA baseball fans know that Bron O'Connor has never not led a UVA team to an NCAA tournament. He's been, you know, I think he started in 2003, so that would be 15 years of NCAA tournaments. He inherited a nice group that helped him get that first team that he coached to an NCAA tournament, and it was recruited by Dennis Womack and his group, you know. O'Connor's first team that went to a tournament included an All-American in Joe Koshansky, an All-American in Ryan Zimmerman, a future major league, long-term major league player still playing now, Mark Reynolds. And so those guys were already in-house when O'Connor took over, and he led that first group to its first NCAA tournament appearance in a long time. But, you know, the resurgence of UVA baseball that, you know, we now attribute, and for the most part rightfully so, certainly to Bron O'Connor, the last couple of teams that Womack had actually had winning records. His last team was on the cusp, and a lot of people thought should have made an NCAA tournament. So, you know, yeah, Dennis Womack didn't leave a bare cupboard for Bron O'Connor. Yeah, he left it in pretty good shape, and O'Connor took it to the next level. But, you know, he had something to work with when he took over, and that's, you know, an important part of the transition of UVA baseball to where it is now was what Womack did in his last couple of years, building the base for O'Connor to then, you know, to jump off from.
And let's not forget, he wasn't recruiting players to this palace that now exists or is going to be even more so. He was recruiting players a baseball field that we knew before Davenport was initially expanded, and that was basically just a bunch of, that was a glorified high school stadium,
I'm
glad. No, the rest of the class, I felt like they were going to make that initial Hall of Fame, and but I'm glad they didn't forget the work that Coach Womack put in.
The only thing I'm surprised by, and I think it's worth a discussion, I'm surprised that O'Connor's not in that class. Now, I probably know why. It's not been said, but he's, you know, why would you, you know, if you're Brian O'Connor, would you want to be part of the first Hall of Fame class? But, you know, honestly, I know he's still the head coach, and he'll be the head coach. He's a young guy. He'll be the head coach for a long time, God willing. I think he's in his late 40s now. So, I mean, 15, 20, 25 years or more, he's still going to be the head coach of UVA baseball if we're all lucky. But that said, you know, I can understand maybe he's a very humble man, and he's a, you know, he's not a Me Too kind of guy. But, you know, if you're going to have a Hall of Fame, I think it would make sense to have him there. So I was surprised not to see O'Connor's name there.
Well, Chris, you know, I'm not certain, but maybe, I'm just speculating on this. This is just a guess. Maybe there was a the bylaws or the initial parameters is that it couldn't be an active player or coach.
Yeah, you could set the rules however you wanted to, though. It's a Hall of Fame, so you know. It's not like the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. I mean, if you really wanted to put O'Connor there, you would have put him there. So I can understand why. But that said, you know, they honored the two most recent coaches, including Coach Womack. They honored a lot of guys. I mean, there was even a player dating back to the early 1900s. And, of course, Mike Cubbage, the 1969-1971 Mike Cubbage, everybody knows, the you know, had a long career in Major League Baseball too. But still, you know, I think it would have made sense. If I would have seen O'Connor's name in there, I guess I wouldn't have been surprised. Maybe that's a better way to put it than I am surprised he's not there. But that's an omission that kind of stands out to me, if nothing else.
Well, here's what wouldn't surprise me. I presented it as a question to you. Would it surprise you at all if you learned, we will never probably, but if O'Connor made it clear he did not want to be put in?
Oh, I'm almost certain that he would have made that clear. Hey, look, have a Hall of Fame. I don't want to be in it. You know, don't put me at least in the first class. You know, because he's still a relatively younger guy. I mean, you know, as a head coach, you know, a guy in his late 40s, he's got you know a long time to go. But yeah, it would surprise me if he didn't say that. Like even if it never got asked him, hey, I just want to make clear here, guys, I'm not in this yet. You know, I don't want to be. Don't put any bust of me in this thing. You know. But that said, that it does stand out to me. Now, I do like, you know, for me as a person who's really come to just love this program and the way he runs it, I love seeing that there were, you know, guys like Tyler Wilson, Danny Hultson from the most recent teams. And we'll see some more names popping up, obviously. We'll see Chris Taylor, who you know, fans will remember that he just had that great World Series with the Dodgers, and we'll see him in there, and we'll see Derek Fisher, and we'll see Mike Poppy, you know, and you know his first group of guys, the Zimmermans and Kashanskis, Mark Reynolds, Jacob Thompson from one of those early teams was in the mix too, yeah, you know, he's the reason there is a Hall of Fame. Brian O'Connor is the reason there is a Hall of Fame. There's a reason we're still watching baseball games there at a stadium that's not that old middle school field we used to play at. I mean, it's a palace because of the work that Brian O'Connor and Carl Kuhn and Coach McMullen and all those players have done. And so, you know, I think at some point I'd like to see him be honored before his career's over. That may be another 20 years or so, and I hope it is 20 years or so, but I'd love to see him honored before his career's over, because – If there's a case to be made for an active guy to be in a Hall of Fame, that case is easily made in the case of Brian O'Connor.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we watch a lot of baseball. We go to a lot of the games, and we know what Brian O'Connor is all about. And I hope it's a long time before he ever if there is such a bylaw that you have to be a retired or you can't get active player or coach. I hope it's a long time before we see Brian O'Connor go in, but whatever his eligibility, whatever he decides it's time, then he'll be there that year, because he represents what Virginia baseball is today. And he's the benchmark. Would you compare Tony Bennett to anyone? But Bennett is benchmarked against O'Connor, so that's a pretty high accomplishment or a compliment you can give someone when you're benchmarking Tony Bennett to Brian O'Connor.
And I've even heard this, and we're talking about the Virginia Baseball Hall of Fame, referring to University of Virginia. But if there was a specific, you know, just State of Virginia Baseball Hall of Fame, he would also be a key guy there, because, and I can't think of where I heard this reference, but I was listening to a radio show driving around one day a few years ago, and how other programs, other baseball programs, college programs in the state have used UVA's success as their own benchmark. And so, you know, you're seeing Virginia Tech, for example, they hired away Maryland's coach, a guy that coached against us in a couple of super regionals in recent years, in part because Virginia Tech says, hey, Virginia's playing good baseball. We want to play good baseball too. Back when Virginia was last place in the ACC every year, nobody cared. Virginia Tech didn't care. You know, you'd have VCU every few years make an NCAA tournament appearance. Maybe JMU every 10 years or so would do the same. But now with Virginia and what Bron O'Connor's brought to Virginia, the consistent high level of success, you've got the Virginia Techs and the VCUs and the Old Dominions, the Radford has built up a great program. Liberty's built up a great program in recent years. All these programs have said, we want the same success Virginia's had. And actually, even stepping down from there, then, you know, the high school circuit in Virginia now, because Virginia's doing so well with players from Virginia. You know, a lot of those guys we mentioned, Ryan Zimmerman is a case example, a guy who played high school ball in Virginia. Now, all of a sudden, national recruiters are saying, hey, we want to go to Virginia and get players to come out and play. And the Major League scouts are looking at guys from Virginia. You know, Chris Taylor's a Virginia native. Justin Verlander's a Virginia native. And so
Mark Reynolds and the
Uptons, I mean, all these guys. And so what Bron O'Connor's done to raise the visibility of the Virginia program with that long-run success, and we're going to continue having success with Bron O'Connor, has done great for the whole of baseball in the state of Virginia and all the players and coaches in Virginia. So, I mean, his impact is beyond just Charlottesville. It really extends out to what's a huge state in this country. It's now a huge baseball hotbed, and you know, I think a lot of that credit should go to Bron O'Connor.
Certainly, and you're right. Tech was pretty content to just having baseball as an afterthought until we became so good, and all of a sudden they're starting to invest in their staff and invest in their facilities. So, we may have created a monster as far as the state college baseball is concerned.
And that, for people like us who love baseball, that's a good thing. You know, we get to, you know, for me and you both, I mean, when we're not at Virginia games, I'm broadcasting VMI Baseball, another program that's had success in recent years. They've got some guys in the minors, some guys in the majors who are successful. Summer baseball, the Valley League, is hot because of the success of a lot of Virginia guys, Virginia, both UVA and, you know, just more colloquially, just guys from the state of Virginia. So, the better baseball is in our state, the better it is for guys like us who love watching it. So I love the fact that Virginia is doing this. It's odd to think that we're not that far away. I think opening day in Davenport, at least, is February 20th. So we're about 2 months away from baseball getting back going. Not that far, really. As far as things go with college baseball getting started. So, you know, we're here in this week of exam week, and we're missing UVA basketball. But we've of course got the football game coming up, the Military Bowl. We haven't had a bowl game in a long time. Basketball's coming back Saturday. Baseball's only a couple months away. So I think we're coping well, Scott, with this absence of sports for the next few days, at least, by at least being able to think about what is still to come.
Yes, we find ways to cope, and for us is the hot stove league, talking about baseball. Winter meetings start tomorrow, or actually tonight. So if you're an MLB subscriber, it's going to be wall-to-wall coverage, and I think there's going to be a lot more activity than people are anticipating. Earlier in the offseason, they thought it was going to be a pretty ho-hum winter league or MLB owners meetings, but now they're thinking there's going to be quite a bit of activity. So if you want to keep up with that, then start watching tonight.
And as we're finishing up this podcast, I got some breaking news coming in, good news continuing to come in for the Virginia football program, and two of its top players, Quinn Blanding and Micah Kaiser, both were named to the second team All-America for the Associated Press this year. Actually, Associated Press had him third team selections. Football Writers Association of America named him the second team. I vote for that Football Writers Association of America team. But so more All-America honors for Quinn Blanding and Micah Kaiser. Not surprising there, but it's good to see, you know, those two guys who came back for their senior seasons rewarded both with a bowl game for their teams, but also those individual accolades, which they certainly deserve.
Oh, they do. And I know we're running out of time, and maybe we can use this, but I'm just going to throw this out for fodder and see what we maybe how we change our thinking. But both of these players are pretty likely first-round choices. I think that's a consensus. So my question is what the heck are they doing playing in the Military Bowl?
Yeah, you know,
maybe we can talk about that a little bit later on, because I've got some pretty strong opinions on that, because I date back to the days of Anthony Poindexter, and can tell you how some misfortune came his way that he's paying a lifetime of having to suffer for.
I think that will be a good tease for our next podcast, and we have to do one later this week. We'll get folks ready for the Davidson game. And also, of course, this is a good starting point for the Military Bowl, because you could also throw Kurt Benkert in there. Benkert is a guy that's getting a lot more attention from draft analysts as maybe a late round pick, and certainly a guy who can go to camp and maybe win a third job with somebody, a number three quarterback job with somebody next year. So, that's a good tease. We'll do that as well as we begin our prep for the Military Bowl. So. But we'll sign off for now. For Scott German, I am Chris Graham. Thank you for listening, and we will talk again soon.